Okay. First of all, I just wanted all of you to join me in thanking this incredible panel, and you can see what amazing work. It's really just been an inspiration for those of us in Detroit to have started this work and had a chance to spread out over the several states and colleagues and friends that we've had and see what the work that's been going on. So in putting together this panel, I was asked to moderate and also try to do an initial synthesis of some of the lessons learned across the slides and the experiences that people have had. I'm going to try to make this quick because we really want to have opportunity for questions and discussion. And I also want to thank my panelists for staying to time, which will enable us to do that. So we want to spend a little bit of time just trying to highlight some of the facilitating factors and lessons learned. And I'm going to focus on the training of trainers and then the subsequent training that went on rather than the subsequent policy work that went on, because that's a whole nother session, if you will. But really trying to think about from a capacity building standpoint, what are some of the lessons learned throughout this process? And I'm sort of divided into four areas that really overlap, but it was my attempt to try to do some theming. The first is related to the curriculum. One of the things that was clearly important is that your curriculum needs to be adaptable to multiple audiences and multiple communities, tailored to local issues, local culture. The inclusion of discrete learning models turned out to be a really, again, as you heard across the panelists, so that you could pick and choose what's going to work in your community, what's going to work for your organizations, the people that you're working with, the campaigns you're already involved with. All of these partnerships and communities were well engaged and entrenched already in doing policy work, as you could tell. Using a participatory planning process with academic and community partners, doing that adaptation, doing that selection of what's going to be most appropriate at the community. Including the local success stories. You heard, you know, two of them today. That really engaged the participants in those initial training of trainers to say, yes, we can do this. Including adaptable learning materials, worksheets, questionnaires, resources. Everybody who attended those trainings of trainers got this binder about like this that had incredible resources. They also had it on a CD-ROM, so it made it easier to adapt. And so that was another thing that people have said was important. Very much related to the curriculum is the actual training approach, the pedagogy. The whole training was based on an experiential learning framework, very interactive, a lot of reflective work. If you saw some examples of that, again, that was a key component. We started with a generic set of knowledge and skills around, you know, power mapping, policy campaign, but then could be adapted irrespective of what your issue was, you know, whether it's hog waste or homelessness or education. So again, we thought that was an important thing. Having a flexible time frame, you know, not imposing this has got to be a two-day workshop, it's got to be a one-day workshop. It's not going to work for in the homeless community, you know, again, those kinds of things. And using a formative evaluation, we didn't have a whole lot of time to talk about that today, but everybody did do some evaluation and then use the results of that to change the training as you went out and continued. The trainers and the participants themselves, it was really important in each of the communities to identify, engage community and academic trainers who have knowledge about the issues, who have skills as trainers, who are well-respected, well-connected in the community. This training didn't train people how to be trainers. Okay, so the understanding was that the people who identified to come to that training of trainers already had those skills. All right, but and they are already well connected, respected, so forth. And then in terms of subsequently going out, the training of trainers going out and doing their training to include leaders and organizers of existing campaigns and organizations in that subsequent training. So people were in a position connected to do something with the skills that they were gaining. Which ties into the next one, too. Participants need to be in a position to apply the training, to have the time, to have the interest, to have the constituents. And then lastly, talking about resources and funding, the first two points are going to seem like they contradict each other. That was not the intent. But the first one is, with a relatively small amount of money, we were able to pull this program off, and then in turn, each of the sites had the $5,000 to do the training in their communities, and a lot has happened as a result of this. At the same time, there was a lot of institutional support that allowed that to happen, and sort of in-kind staffing that wasn't, you know, wouldn't show up in the bottom line budget, but never could have happened without that. So people like Renee's time, for example, Chris's time, and so forth. But so that gets you to the second point, is that you really do need ongoing support, funding, staff to provide this kind of training, and most importantly, the follow-up. You know, it's not enough just to do training. It's that ongoing support and policy work mobilizing. And that partnerships, as a result of all this, the partnerships are in a position to pursue funding for policy advocacy work, you know, themselves, and not specifically tied with any further training or any role that we would have. This is just to point out some resources in terms of the URC. I want to acknowledge Policy Link. They've been on some of our slides, but I don't think they got explicitly mentioned. They initially did a training of trainers of us in Detroit. And then we adapted that training to our Detroit neighborhood, and then in turn adapted it for the training of trainers. So it's sort of a so-and-so begat so-and-so. But we always acknowledge them on the materials. This is a really important lesson learned, that if you're using somebody else's materials, acknowledge where the original source was. And with that, just to end with one of our quotes from a Detroit resident, the most important thing about the training is knowing that I have power that will positively impact my neighborhood, and that now I know how to use it. Okay, so I want to, as those of you who got here after I did my initial spiel, I'm on my way to the airport with apologies because of the parade. I'm leaving a little early because I don't want to miss my plane. Jen Brown has graciously, who was one of our other moderators, agreed to do the question and answer. So, again, I apologize, and big hugs to all my wonderful panel members. And I'm going to see Naeem in a couple weeks. I look forward to that.
So we had a fantastic panel. What a great example of taking work that started in one area and moved to other sites around the country. Now hopefully we can all go back to our communities and continue to replicate this great opportunity that national conferences provide. So what information do you need from the panelists now? What questions do you have so that you can do that? They were so clear. Please, sir.
All the presentations talk about the importance of having good data to describe issues and problems, and being able to develop data locally as it relates to research in the topic area that's of concern. The work I do with alcohol and drug issues, using the same kinds of approaches that you're talking about, we find it really important to develop data about alcohol and drug problems in the local itself, using concepts and research from national sources and best practices, the defensive of the medic and so on. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you guys use data and how you recommend localities develop their own data.
And we do have panels. If you, I don't know if you want to come up or answer from here, but whoever wants to start with that.
Can I just say a very quick thing? It's sort of a plug for community-based participatory research. And there's a lot of great resources out to how to go about doing that. But the URC has some, including an interactive CD-ROM. There's some really good trainings around. You could pick up some information as well as find out about the experiences of many of the partners here.
Yeah, and one of the things we did in North Carolina, as we did the study that I mentioned called Community Health Effects of Industrial Hog Operations, well, as a community organizer, I was recruiting community participants. And once the communities were recruited, then we would hold a three-hour training session where we walked the community, the people, the participants through the steps that they would have to take. But another part of that included talking about why we even had to have this research, why did we even have to have the training. Because for me, that was important for people to connect the dots, is what I called it. Why do we need to be looking at these effects? And why are these places, why are they choosing our communities to set up shop? You know, and so people can begin talking about that. And also encouraging neighbors to talk to one another. Because, you know, in the U.S., we got this little quiet way of suffering. I suffer, you suffer, we all suffer from the same thing, but we're not talking to each other. So how do we begin talking about this And those training sessions was a way to get neighbors talking to one another, recognizing that we all going through the same thing. And we also had done a map of North Carolina, and we pinned red dots on the map to identify the location of each operation. And then the community, when they saw the map, they were like in awe because they didn't realize that all this existed around mm-hmm. them. And they were able to see exactly where they lived in relationship to where this stuff was, and that sent another light bulb off for them. And so then a whole new discussion opened up. And of course, I had, you know, talk about the capitalism being the reason why all this stuff exists, profit over people, and, you know, just the need in this country for people to get rich quick while they make everybody else poor. And so to hold those kinds of discussions so we can connect all the dots and understand the total picture of the oppression going on.
Thank you, Naomi. Okay. Rena, you had something.
Oh, and so I just want to mention, too, we mentioned at the beginning it was a part of the Kellogg Community Health Scholars Program, so that in each of these communities, as Naima has demonstrated, there were assigned postdoctoral scholars working with communities, and they had the data. They had developed that data together and knew that moving the data into policy change was what really needed to happen to impact the problem of fog waste in those communities. So that's why we worked in each of these communities, because there were powerful partnerships between academia, practice, and communities to be able to move the data they all had to develop together into policy.
Question in the back.
In North Carolina, though, the training trainers was delivered twice with us, and the example that we showed was the first time it was delivered and then what came from that. The second time it was delivered in Raleigh, and then there was some focus on the Hispanic population from what I understand, but it was up to them to decide what are they going to do with it from there. I don't have a lot of information on the results of that, but that it was an opportunity to gain the skills mm-hmm. for that population. But for policy analysis skills, most people had just participated in public rallies before they came to join as volunteers. A lot of the members in Greensboro were from churches, and so that they wanted to make sure that these the pollution was not happening in their neighborhood, and so there was not an experience of policy analysis before getting into movement.
And for the environmental movement in North Carolina, there is a large Latino population that's affected, but the problem, of course, we know in this country is racism and how it's set up to divide and conquer. And so trying to build unity between the black and brown, we are working in that effort. And everything that we do, we always try to outreach to the Latino community, in particular in the livestock industry, because a lot of the Latino workers are in the livestock industry, and so, you know, they are being affected as the same as the black community that's living in these communities where this stuff is housed. So we try to use that as a way to build unity. And we hold meetings in one of the communities that's heavily populated with those hogs. And there's a Latino population that always attend. And so all materials are produced in English and in Spanish so that we can communicate. And I work with another organization called Black Workers for Justice. We have translation material. So whenever needed, I'll take the translation material to the meeting in order to help, you know, with the communications and stuff. but we are aware that, you know, this is a problem. And North Carolina is just so backwards in its laws. You know, it's a right to work state, so there's a lot of things that keep people from participating in stuff, because they will use your job against you if they find out you were at a meeting. People have been fired, family members have been fired because I went to a meeting, you know. And the one little funny story I tell you real quick is that I have two daughters in Philadelphia. Anyway, when the H1N1 was high in being talked about, Al Jazeera Network English contacted the EJ Network office. They wanted to come to North Carolina, so they said, can we get somebody to escort us to Duplin County, which is the hog capital of the world, because they have 2.2 million hogs in Duplin County, 45 hogs to every person in the county. So I volunteered, because I've been wanting to hang with Al Jazeera for a long time. So anyway, I was totally excited about going with them. So I called my daughter in Philadelphia, who was working at Temple at the Center for Public Policy, and I called her and I said, oh, honey, what? Guess what your mama getting ready to do? She's like, what are you ready to do there, Naima? I said, I'm getting ready to go hang out with Al Jazeera. She said, my doggone you, that's why I ain't gonna never get no good government job. So we went down, you know, and we interviewed community members and drove them through showing them various things about the effects of these hogs. And in the 5 minutes of us being in the county, the sheriff was following us. The hog farm, one of the hog farmers, they're not farmers, one of the hog operators' wife was following us. And then they asked us what we doing on the road. We was like, is this public or private? And they said, public, well, we got every right to be out here as you do. And, you know, so when they seen you weren't scared, and my thing was, Al Jazeera ain't scared of y'all. They done been over there where they bumming people and everything. Y'all think you gonna scare them? You know, so it was fun. But anyway, I'm gonna be quiet until somebody else have a chance.
I could sit and listen to you all day long. Both to the point of research and policy analysis, there are some people in the community and that were engaged in the effort that had organizing expertise, some people who had research expertise, some people who had policy analysis expertise. But really, the goal was to try to get more people with those skills, right? And through the participatory research, through the policy analysis, through the organizing and, you know, sort of critical analysis that we're doing, I mean, that's really the important part, because it's not just about speaking truth to power. I mean, the powerful know the truth. The problem, or what we need to do is we need to speak power to power. And so I think that the importance of organizing and bringing people together around these issues, and, you know, in Baltimore, you know, working with people who are experiencing homelessness, not a whole lot of power, you know, in sort of the our capitalist democracy, right? I think that's really, really important.
And I just want to mention also fairly quickly that it depends how you define policy analysis and skills, because we had people from the university, of course, who might have had formal policy analysis skills, but when you get to the really, when you get to the power mapping and you look at who's the decider and someone says, and it's the mayor or something, someone will say, now who's in that person's church? And they'll do their own policy analysis. And say, and I know that person, I know his needs, or I know his something other, and how can we get to them? And they do that analysis, and then we walk into that office and they say, hi, Joe, and, you know, they've been together for, they know each other for many years, and they've worked for that person to get them in the office, and they're the constituent. And the policy, the person with the policy, formal policy skills, you sit there, because I've done this, I sit there and I'm nobody, but the constituent, they're all over the constituent. So it depends what you mean by policy analysis skills, who has the power in that situation.
I think we have time for one more question.
Where
do we go with the hog issue? I mean, do we need something like the Cesar Chavez grape strike?
Yes, we
don't,
do.
Don't buy grapes, you know, in front of every grocery store throughout the United States. Is that what, because they'll always come back and say, well, everybody wants cheap food, nobody wants to pay this much for a pork chop.
And that's what they say, too.
So this is what you get if you want cheap food.
So I always leave people with, we got Thanksgiving coming up and Christmas, and everybody like those Smithfield ham and butterball turkey. We ask you not to buy those products. When you buy those products, you contribute to what we deal with in North Carolina. But Smithfield is the owner from birth to death of those 10 million hogs. And they bought out Butterball, so then they own up all those too. And the poultry industry is on a re-entry into North Carolina. So now that's another battle that we're having to take on.
So it's full employment for you, but the work will never end.
That's right. Never.
But are you trying to gear up? This is a huge, it seems to be a huge effort to do that kind of organizing across the country to get the word out, to have people saying, don't buy. I mean, it's a strike, essentially, against purchasing these
right,
items
right.
These products that are killing people.
And
the policy change, like the moratorium policy, you can focus on those different strategies other than just fighting the industry. But
well,
it's
let
a whole
me know
lot
when
of
you want me to stand out front of the place.
We just came out of our 14th annual Environmental Justice Summit, and that was one of the ideas was to plan a day of action where we ask everybody to participate, and we'll call it Let's End Environmental Racism, Environmental Injustice. And as a day of action, and we'll be asking people to do something where they live in support of that.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all of our panelists again for giving us some good tools and things to think about the connection between research and policy and research, and things that we can take back to our own communities. And thanks all of you for attending and wading through the giant celebration. Krishna, do you have one thing that you wanted to add?
I just had one thing. First, so this is interesting. There's no young people on our panel. But
I'm young.
Well, let me say that in those trainings, the initial trainings in Detroit, half of the participants were youth and young people, and I'm talking about like under 21 years of age. And that was an important part of our strategy all along. And in the Latino community, particularly in Detroit, where, we did everything in Spanish, et cetera, but it was the youth who were the first one who stepped up when the bilingual school was getting closed, and that community was going to have to go across town to another school to go to school. And so it was the passion and drive and some of the social media tools that the youth were being able to bring, as well as being great at coming up with the data, being great at crafting the questions. So remember, as we go about this, that we build connections across communities, across disciplines, across academic community, but also across age to build this work and continue this work.
Can I add to that real quick? And just to add to that, and one of the other things we consistently talk about in North Carolina with our communities in particular, because y'all know how this funding world goes, and one of the ways they get communities off track is offering funding. So we always, I'm an advocate that say to communities I work with all the time, don't get trapped by the funding. Because when the money is gone, all this crap is still here, but I don't say it that nice, but I'm going to be nice to that. But also we work with, we're building network with the workplace activities in North Carolina, with the workers, like their unions operating in North Carolina.